Committee on Business and Labor, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2429.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2429 extends the criteria for a qualified property fee exempt from property tax under the state's enterprise zone program if the business firm complies with prevailing wage law on specified projects with an estimated value of at least $5 million. We are still waiting for the fiscal and revenue analysis on the bill, and there is a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee.
All right. Mr. Shipwreck, I imagine you're on the list to talk. You want to just come on up here and tell us about this, please.
Thank you.
Bob, bring anybody with you that you think is going
to
be helpful.
Jim wants to say a word.
Very good.
Good morning.
And whenever you're ready, guys.
Mr. Chairman, members of the House Business and Labor Committee. For the record, I'm Bob Shipwreck. I'm Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council, and had introduced House Bill 2429, which I believe will help clean up a problem that workers and contractors working in enterprise zones in Oregon are facing. I've got a number of things I'm going to go through, but I would promise the committee I'll be very brief. The bill does a couple things, but I wonder, Mr. Chair, if I might just for a minute, I'm not sure everyone knows what an enterprise zone is in the first place. And secondly, probably not everybody on the committee is aware of what the prevailing wage law is. So I take just a minute to just explain those two concepts. Today in Oregon, there are 56 enterprise zones. 47 of them are rural. 100 cities are sponsors of enterprise zones. 3 ports. 30 counties, although 35 counties have enterprise zones within them. So it's a lot of the state is an enterprise zone, and one Indian tribe. Last year, 2007, $1.3 billion of property taxes were abated, saving about $17.5 million in taxes. In a 4 or 5 year abatement, typically, they're 3 years. You could have 4 or 5, and we've seen one that went 14 years. But for a 4 and 5 year abatement, the permanent employees of the project must be paid at 150% of the county average wage. These are not the construction workers, but the permanent employees. Last year, in 2007, there were a total of 133 projects statewide within these enterprise zones. Only 30 of these projects would be affected by the bill because they were over $5 million. A little bit about prevailing wage, if you're not familiar with it. The law was passed in 1959. Governor Mark Hatfield signed the bill. It's designed to mirror the federal Davis-Bacon Act, which was signed in 1931 by then President Hoover. It applies to public projects over $50,000. Last legislative session extended the law to certain public-private partnerships. In 1995, the law was changed to require all non-residential contractors to be surveyed annually. About 7,000 contractors are surveyed annually today. This data is collected by the State Employment Department, collated by craft, by region. There are 14 regions around the state. This data is all collected, given to the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and we come up with what is known as the Boley Book. This book is then distributed to all public agencies, and I'm just turning to Region 3. We're in Region 3, Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties. It shows the list of crafts and the wages and fringes that would be paid. The intent of going to the annual surveys was to try and eliminate the fact that some people felt that these wages were not accurate before 1995. And in fact, there is some truth to that. Today, however, we can say that the prevailing wage law for the state is, in fact, the market rate paid in these various localities. I've distributed to some of you, and I apologize, I don't have enough for the whole committee. I went to my office last night to make copies, and the machine broke down. So, anyway, there are two studies I wanted.
Excuse me, Bob. We're having copies made, I understand.
Oh, that's very nice. There's a couple studies that I just wanted to briefly allude to because there's so much misinformation about prevailing wage that it's not the real wage. I've just explained to you that our state economists, in fact, survey the state. There's two studies that I've just, and I've got lots of studies, but there's two that I particularly like. And this was put together by the Federal Highway Administration. They took a look at all 50 states and looked at what the wages were in those 50 states. And there were low wage, medium wage, and high wage. And Oregon is a high wage state.
And Sean, Bob, before Mr. Miller leaves, just to be fair, in case Mr. Miller's copy machine breaks down, we'll provide copies for him, too.
Well, thank you. It's got a big dent in it, by the way, now.
How do you dent plastic?
What the Federal Highway study shows, and you'll see it, it's all over the place, but it shows what productivity and high wages and good training and skills and good quality workers can do. Although Oregon is a relatively high wage state for highway construction, our cost per, what they did is they measured a mile of paved freeway. That in all of these instances, and Oregon came out, I think, about the second best in the whole country. My favorite is Texas. I always look at Texas comparisons. Get this, their wage rate is $11.82. This is 2002. The total cost per mile was about 750,000 miles. Dollars per mile. Find Oregon here, just for your benefit. Oregon's costs were about $500,000 per mile. The labor costs were $109,000. The labor costs in Texas were $116,000. So despite a wage rate almost a third less than Oregon's, it actually costs the taxpayers more to pave a mile of highway. The other study I thought was pretty interesting, there's a university in Missouri did a test. These were all states in the northern, north-central part of the country. And they did a comparison of states that had a prevailing wage and states that didn't have a prevailing wage. Then they collated, and they actually went to the types of facilities. At the end of this study, they found that there was essentially, I'll just quote this, analyzing data for 93 through 2002, the authors found, quote, no statistically significant difference in mean cost of construction between the 8 wage law states and 4 states without such statutes. So that's another good study, I thought, that shows that the prevailing wage really is not the cost driver some people make it out to be. I want to talk now just about, you do have a handout there that I did have enough copies of. just a little history of the problem. This would be this handout here. It's not titled. It was put together for me by a man named John Williams. He's a researcher and researches these issues all across the United States. He lives in Portland, though, and I've known him for many years, and he's followed this issue around Oregon for some time, and he put this together for me. I'm not going to read this whole thing. It's six pages. But you can go ahead and take a look at it. The fact is, there have been a number of instances in Oregon, and recently just two, which really brought the bill forward, and I'll talk to you about that. In some instances where you have a project, for instance, like a powerhouse, and some of these are in enterprise zones, the construction payroll is much, much greater than the permanent employees. You'll have 400 or 500 different construction workers on a powerhouse lasting about 2 years of construction. And your permanent employees, particularly on the new gas-fired turbines and stuff, are about 20 full-time employees once it's built. So there's a tremendous amount of construction wages, payroll paid on some of these projects that are perhaps not captured by the city or county that, or in the state of Oregon, because out-of-state contractors and workers may be constructing the project. There's John put together some of the projects. I'm not going to go through all of them. Some of you have heard this before, but some projects we've seen, in Boise Cascade, St. Helens, Lone Star Cement and Baker, 70% of all the license plate counts were out-of-state workers. It seems to be, I'm not going to say it's getting worse, but it certainly has not got any better. You've got the Calpine Hermiston project, the Georgia Pacific Wana paper mill, the first job that was completed about 3 years ago. The contractor from Colorado brought in the majority of the workforce from the south. Frankly, the local politicians there, in fact, the commissioners of Clatsop and Columbia counties and the Port of St. Helens all passed resolutions deploring the use of out-of-state workers on an enterprise zone project, and we're very unhappy about it. The contractor failed miserably, was thrown off the project. We finished it at cost plus. Luckily, the lessons learned there, most of the work in that particular enterprise zone has been done by local workers and local contractors. U.S. Gypsum in Rainier, you might recognize the BE&K from Alabama, was the general contractor on that project. Hyundai in Eugene, when they retooled it, they brought in about 200 Korean workers rather than the local Oregon workers. There were massive tax breaks on that project. Now, of course, that plant has went away. The Lowe's Distribution Center in Lebanon, another example of a problem, $100 million project. The company got $1.5 million in tax breaks. Several out-of-state contractors and workers, the Cruise Line Call Center in Eugene, Wind Farm, Albany Paper Mill. Then last but not least, what really prompted this, I guess, and I'm not going to belabor it, but Gatorade wanted to build a Gatorade factory in Albany. We estimate that the tax breaks, total tax breaks, not just the tax abatements, was about $60 million. That's what the city told us. We thought it was 70. They said 60. I'll go with their number. The contractor they intended to use was out of Jacksonville, Florida. Talked to the contractor. They intended to bring their typical subcontractors with them, along with their workforce. We knew this because this company builds a lot of plants around the country, and we could track what their track record had been. That project eventually went away. I don't know if it was the economy or the fact that the city council changed and there was a new mayor in Albany who didn't appreciate the project in the first place. But this would have been a real bad thing. The thing I wanted to share with you is that, you know, I went and spoke to the folks in Albany and in Linn County commissioners, and I asked them, this is about a $300 million project. I said, didn't you ever ask Gatorade, which is owned by Pepsi, didn't you ever ask Pepsi about who is going to build this plant? And the commissioner goes, it never crossed my mind. And I thought, my goodness, giving away these types of tax breaks and then not even getting even a commitment to local hire of the construction workforce seemed really bad to me. The other project of recent, just recently, is the FedEx project in out by Troutdale. It's on the site of the former aluminum plant there. A very large project. It's a distribution center. We were told by the owner and contractor that Oregon didn't have anybody. The buildings are all metal buildings. We were told that Oregon just didn't have anybody that knew how to construct a metal building, and they were going to bring their workers from Texas.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Bring them in from Texas because we didn't know how to build a building, metal building. We actually intervened on that project, cost them about 6 months, and then did show them that indeed we did have people that knew how to build metal buildings. One of the things, as I wind down here, that I've tried to work with the local government on this, and I should throw in the state of Oregon, too. They're just as culpable, in my opinion, is that these projects, when they come in these little communities like this, they really turn the community upside down. People do not appreciate the fact that there's tax abatements that they're paying for, yet them or their neighbors might not be even working on these projects. So it's affected the politics in these little towns. I've alluded to Albany. The city council was turned over there. Just in Turner, right down the street, the same thing happened. Someone wanted to build a powerhouse. We knew that they were going to bring in their work. The same people that failed at the Wanna paper mill. The next election, that project went away because of the politics of it. The other thing that's going on that is very frustrating and also highlights why I think we need a law like this, these projects now, believe it or not, it's like it's all cloaked in secrecy. We don't even know, we, the public, don't even know these discussions are going on. The Google plant in the Dalles, for instance, was called O2. They have code names. You don't read about these projects until it's a done deal. They've got their tax breaks, they've got their contractors lined up, and then there might be a press release, oh, there's going to be a plant built. They actually take and have the local officials sign documents to say you can't talk about our project. And this is coming from the owners. So there's no opportunity for the public to have any input up front on who might be building these projects. I forget the code name for the Gatorade plant. It was something mysterious. But it's getting out where it's very difficult to even get a handle on what's happening. So that's led to the problem. Just in closing, I want to just say this, because I don't believe in whining, and I want to make it clear that this state has an awesome construction workforce. I just want to, just a couple examples. It's an opportunity for me to blow my horn about my affiliates, but we spend a lot of money on apprenticeship and training. I've showed you the studies, the one Oregon specific. But a couple just quick stories that I just feel real proud about. So the committee understands that there's no reason that out-of-state workers and or at least the out-of-state workers have to come here. I spoke to the project manager for Hunt Construction. They had just finished the U of O Autzen Stadium project. And I was visiting with him, seeing how the job went and everything, and he says, Bob, I have built stadiums all over the United States. And he says, I'll tell you what, I wish I could take every worker that was on this job and take them with me to build others. He says, it's the best workforce I've ever had. That was in Eugene, Oregon, not New York or San Francisco or anywhere else. The Google plant in the Dalles that I alluded to, two of our contractors did get some work on that project. They did such a good job that Google fired the ones that they used to use and took our two Oregon contractors and some of their workers on plants in other places across the United States. We're putting in wind turbines and ethanol plants that are setting records. Nobody could build an ethanol plant as quickly as we did. We checked with the Midwest. The wind turbine folks said the same thing, that nobody can put these up as well as we are. I saw Mayor Tom here, and we're doing a fantastic job at Solar World and Genentech in the Hillsboro area. And they, even though there was a disaster on the Wana paper machine, they must have learned their lesson because they used all local contractors. And the owner of they're renowned by the Koch brothers, said they had never had a paper machine built in the United States as fast as we had just finished down at Wana. So there's a great story to be told. You have these dislocations, however, that are extraordinarily troublesome. They divide the communities. It's not right. The state, local government loses tax money. So I've given you the numbers. Many of the projects, and the vast majority for that matter, in enterprise zones would not be impacted by the bill, because some of them, I didn't realize there's a lot of small projects in enterprise zones, and the amount of public subsidy doesn't really raise to a level where I think it's justified. With that, I'll stop.
Tim, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tim Nickel. I represent the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and to be extremely brief, I'll just say that we support this bill. And I personally took all those pictures.
Bob, my question that really begs to be asked here is, explain to me, just a labor, how this is going to prevent some of the problems that you just called out for us.
Sure. I don't know exactly why. But you take a look at the public works projects in Oregon, the freeways, the public buildings, all that. I'm not going to say you never see out-of-state workers on them, but I can't think of a good example where you have. I really can't. Having a prevailing wage job really does work. I mean, that's the intent of prevailing wage laws, is to have local hire, and it works. It's just not an issue on state and federal. Now, you're going to have some out-of-state contractors, because Oregon's a relatively small state. We don't have a tunnel boring contractor, for instance, like this doing the big pipe, and certainly other types of construction. But those are big national contractors that come into Oregon, and they generally hire locally anyway. But that's the answer. It works. Prevailing wage laws work, and that's why I think in these, well, the 30 projects in the 2007, I think it'd be helpful.
And I know we do have contractors that can build metal buildings. I was aware of that before today.
Well, that one kind of took us by surprise.
Unbelievable. Questions of these? Representative Cameron, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Bob, for your testimony.
Thank you.
I guess I want to follow up on the question. How would this bill, let's use the project in Hermiston, for example, reduce the number of out-of-state license plates that show up on the job? I don't see anything in the bill that would reduce the number of out-of-state plates.
I can tell you that, because it was the same contractor that was at the Wanna Mill. They're paying their pipe fitters and electricians $21 an hour, no fringes. They get a whopping amount of what we call per diem, probably $60 to $80 a day, which taxes are not paid on, so they're subsidized in that fashion.
Great.
It's the productivity. If they're required to pay the area standard wages of a pipe fitter and electrician, there would be no incentive to bring in your help from the south. You're going to hire locally, just as every other project in that area, by the way, was local hire. We built an ethanol plant, two more gas-fired turbines, and of course we've got work at the Boardman coal-fired plant, all done locally. But that's the answer.
And before, as a follow-up, Bob, there's no taxes paid on that per diem.
No.
So we're losing some revenue as well.
Well, that's the scam. You pay them $21 and, you know, on the check, and then you give them $80 a day for subsistence.
Okay. Follow-up?
Yeah. Another point you brought up was the secrecy that happens.
Yeah.
How does this change anything about secrecy?
It doesn't.
Okay.
That it, this bill would be a response to the fact that we have no opportunities to even influence who might construct these facilities. I just threw the secrecy in there just to let you know what's going on.
One more
for
me, Mr. Chair. And then, Bob, you mentioned Google. We did such a great job that they took our jobs out of state and to build their plants. How does that impact our workforce here in Oregon and the future of having a good quality workforce when they're going other places to build?
These workers were supervision. They're foremen and superintendents, not the journeyman apprentices.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you. Bob, is there a more direct way in enterprise zones to require Oregon hiring?
No, that's the problem. I've got an attorney general opinion. It's fairly dated, but I can tell you this. It's been tested all over the country, and it is a restraint of trade for a city or county to say you're going to hire locally. It's illegal, unconstitutional. I'll leave it to the lawyers to go from there, but there is one thing you could do. You could require it. Hiring out of local unemployment offices or union halls, but I didn't think I could get the votes for that one.
Might get one.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. You were talking about the prevailing wage surveys and all that, and how contractors and subcontractors across Oregon are surveyed. But they're non-residential contractors. Non-residential
correct.
Contractors are residential contractors are not subject to prevailing wage, correct?
Not our prevailing wage. The only prevailing wage or a residential contractor would be subject to would be the federal HUD rates when they're building housing authority stuff, things like that.
Follow up.
Please. It's very low.
Well, what I'm wondering is those that are surveyed, how many of them are working on projects that are already mostly subject to prevailing wage versus those who are not already subject to prevailing wage?
I can't answer that, Representative Thatcher. I don't know.
The reason I ask, Mr. Chair, is we've gotten those surveys at our company, and I'm thinking, okay, so I'm just parroting back what I'm already required to pay, so mm-hmm. It has become de facto a prevailing wage. So it just is kind of confusing if you're actually surveying everybody and finding out what everybody is paying versus only a select few that might already be subject to the prevailing wage law. It just doesn't seem, I think that's where the objections come on it not being a prevailing wage.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher raised a good question. The fact that we survey about 7,000 contractors, and when I look at bid lists on public works, I recognize them all. That's a finite number. I would suggest that most of what we're surveying is not prevailed work, because when you look at the Boley book, you'll see as you go through it, there's a lot of crafts, particularly outside of Portland, where the union scale does not prevail. It's an average wage, which that's what people are working at. I'm not disputing that. That's what the economists have found. So I should have said that in my testimony. The prevailing wage is not union scale across the board.
And there is a prevailing wage advisory committee. Matter of fact, I got a letter from Commissioner Vaki and appointed two new people, but and I'm grateful we have a union signatory contractor on this committee, not just prevailing wage earners. But, you know, I'll get right to you, Representative Vice. And I remember Bob, you said a few years ago that some contractor said, I don't mind paying union scale, but I'll be damned if I'll pay prevailing wage.
I know.
And, you know, on some of the things you said earlier, you know, I have a history and a voting record of supporting enterprise zones, tax mm-hmm. credits, tax abatements, tax sure. deductions to incent people to come here and invest. And in fact, I've got the holy crap beat out of me on some progressive websites by some of our friends in politics for being supportive of voting for more of those in 2005 than my good friends Karen Minnis and Wayne Scott. I voted for more tax credits, deductions, abatements than any legislator in the House in 2005. And then, because I believe and agree in incenting investment and retention of investment in the state, but then just to get this thrown back in my face, it really upsets me, because I want Oregonians making these family wages. Now, I don't got anything against Alabama or Mississippi, Texas, or whatever. But you know what? I do that because I want Oregonians working, building America. And then when we run out of people, then the people are welcome to come here and help us. But Representative Holvey, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, thanks for your presentation. I think you made it pretty apparent that prevailing wage just helps make sure that contractors don't come in from out of state with a workforce and underbid our local markets, and that's how we try to keep local hire the best we can, is just making it a competitive marketplace for our local contractors. I have one problem with the bill, and that's the $5 million figure. I'd like to see that about $1 million. I mean, where did you come up with $5 million? Seems kind of high.
I picked it out of the air, and then...
scientific.
I see straight. Well, I had to have a number in there to get the bill printed. And then I got this report, which I have given to the committee room administrator. It's put together by the State Economic and Community Development Department. And actually, $5 million makes a lot of sense once you look at the graphs, in that there's just a lot of projects. I didn't realize this in enterprise zones, that just there's not that much public subsidy in them. They're just a lot of small projects that or they wouldn't even come up to the $50,000 level that we currently have. That's why. And when you look at the graphs, it actually makes a lot of sense. So it was a lucky guess, in my opinion. It captures the vast bulk of the construction dollar. I'll be happy to get that by you.
Yeah, I'd like to see that.
You and bet. Before I go to Representative Kenemer, you know, there's states in this country that prevail. If a penny in it prevails, if I'm right. Not correct.
We have a relatively high level.
Right, and there's, I know my friend from Eugene and I have discussed adjusting, amending that level. This is, people that are opposed to this should be grateful that my friend from Eugene down there and I are ones deciding where it prevails. Because I can assure you, it'd be a lot lower than this. Representative Kenemer.
Bob, you alluded to a difference between prevailing wage and union scale, yes. And I've been out of the loop for a while. I'm just trying to understand, kind of an oblique comment, and I don't really know how those relate nowadays.
The union scale is, of course, what is collectively bargained. And in every region, you're going to have union rates apply, depending on the craft.
Sure.
The more rural you get, the more you're going to have what we call the average wage, which is not...
In that process.
It is not union scale, because this is how it's arrived at. It's really simple. The economists, when they take the surveys, to have union scale prevail, 50% or more of the hours worked in that region by that craft have to be there. If it's not,
it goes to what is a weighted average. Mm-hmm. And that so you would get some union hours or dollars, non-union, and then the economists do their magic with developing the weighted average. So it's in some cases it's many dollars below scale, union scale. And I'd be happy to share the book with you if you.
We got that. Oh, no,
why don't you just get us all copies of that?
Yeah,
please. That way we're all.
That way you can look at it, and for your own districts, it might be interesting for you to know just what's being paid.
Representative Witt, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Bob and Tim.
Good morning.
I was going to ask, Bob, if you had any information about labor productivity, and I see in this this handout that there actually is some discussion about that, and I think there is another study out of a university in Utah.
Yes.
That is more extensive.
There's that one, and that's the one you're holding. It comes from the Federal Highway Administration study of the mile of pavement. But there's another one out. I haven't written. That's fairly recent.
Yeah.
On productivity and training.
Yeah. This is what I was looking for. Thank you.
Any further questions before we move on here, folks? All right, then. Thanks, guys. And we're not going to work this bill today. We don't have a fiscal.
I was just going to show you.
Go ahead.
Just to show you how long this is. We had a rally on the steps of the Capitol three sessions ago. And so this isn't just a new issue.
No.
I did bring some extras. If some of you would like to have one of these for your office, you're more than welcome.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to get the advocates out of the way first. Duke Shepherd, please.
And then if anybody else would like to testify on behalf and in support of the bill, please let me know, because I'm going to do all you first, and then we have a nice list of nice people that have other things to say. Go ahead, Mr. Shepherd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Duke Shepherd with the AFL-CIO. Just here to say we support the bills proposed. Bob hit the numbers. It is important to keep in mind the relatively limited number of firms to which this would apply. I mean, there are 91,000 businesses in Oregon, at least listed on the Employment Department website as of last night. The number that participate in Enterprise Zone that are in projects over $5 million, you're talking, as Bob said, 30 or fewer. So the standard is one that could be met by firms on those projects, and it's not going to be such a hardship that it would reduce investment in communities that desperately need it. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Mr. Shepherd? All right, thanks, Duke. I'm going to call Sean Miller, Dave Cutts, I hope I'm saying that right, and Carl Redmond, please. Whenever you're ready, Sean.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sean Miller here today on behalf of the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors. I first of all want to thank the chair. I appreciate the offer to make our copies. We did hand out copies, and we wanted to make sure that the taxpayer wasn't picking up that paper cost.
Thank you, Sean. We try to be as fair and balanced in this room as we can.
I appreciate that.
I knew you'd appreciate that.
I appreciate that. And I want to make a few comments just based on what Mr. Shipwreck purported in House Bill 2429. We are here today in opposition of the bill, but the merits of why they're pushing the bill is something that we're in agreement with. It's not the fact that we're applying prevailing wage on projects. It's the fact that we also support encouraging local hire. Contractors that I represent work in this state and employ Oregonians in this state. And so we obviously want the opportunity to work on those jobs as Bob and his members want to work on these particular jobs. The problem we have with this particular bill, 2429, is that requiring prevailing wage on private projects doesn't really do anything to require local hiring. you know, there is legal issues of requiring local hire. What this, all this really does is just put a new, more or less impediment for enterprise zones and the attraction of businesses to those enterprise zones. You know, we talked about some of the of why enterprise zones exist. It's obviously to attract businesses and to produce long-term jobs. There's a lot of requirements, a lot of strings attached to bringing those long-term jobs to these communities. And we are worried that if this particular bill were to be passed, to be enacted into law, that when businesses look at enterprise zones around the state of Oregon and they look at attracting business to Oregon, that they simply choose another state. And if they choose another state, we don't even have the opportunity to work on those jobs. And, you know, we can debate prevailing wage, but really I think this comes down to is economic development and the difference between attracting those businesses into Oregon versus having them go somewhere else. And, you know, want to also just touch on a little history as well from last session. Those of you that served on this committee worked on House Bill 2140. Bob, Mr. Shipwreck, worked on that bill, and it was a priority of his organization. We also worked on that bill. It was before the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee, for which I am a member of. And that particular bill, if you remember or recall, dealt with public projects versus private projects, and how do you deal when there's this new phenomena of a public-private partnership. And as Bob alluded to, the prevailing wage law was created for public projects. And with some of the new projects, especially with the Portland Development Commission, there was an issue of, okay, how do you deal with these public-private partnerships when there is a subsidy given to actually do the project? And the bill that passed last session created a $750,000 threshold of what would be considered a subsidy to do that project. And so again, it was it is a public-private partnership. That bill did move forward and did pass last session. When you look at what defines what a subsidy is in that law, and again, this committee addressed that last session, passed pretty handily on through the House and Senate, was signed by the governor. Funds of a public agency does not include tax credits or tax abatements. And so we specifically made a policy decision last session to define what a subsidy is, but also define the difference between what a subsidy is and how you're going to address economic development. This particular bill goes back and says we want to have those economic development projects, tax credits, tax abatements, and the issues within enterprise zones considered in prevailing wage. And so I just want to express our concern with going this direction because, you know, like Bob, we want our local contractors and local workers working. The construction industry needs a lifeline right now, just as the rest of the Oregon economy, and we're worried that if this, were enacted, those businesses would go elsewhere and we wouldn't even have the opportunity to build these jobs and to bring those long-term jobs to Oregon. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will conclude my remarks and allow Carl Redmond and Dave Coots to testify.
Yeah, we're actually going to amend that too. Go ahead, guys, whenever you're ready. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Carl Redmond. I'm the Vice President of Bear Electric, a locally homegrown 31-year company in the Donald area. And my number one concern is creation of jobs and retention of jobs. So I certainly share Mr. Shipwreck's concern there. That's all I want to see is our guys working and people in the state working. I'm not the people that want to see anybody from out of state coming in, working jobs that my guys, our team, should be on. My concern, as Mr. Miller mentioned, is that the creation of these enterprise zones is for job development. And I think the market-based construction economy plays a role in that. You know, we need to be competitive, and we need to be sure that what we're attracting these other companies here to build their buildings for, that we maintain that same attraction through being competitive for job creation. And I also sit on the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee, and I am somewhat surprised that, you know, we're at this point without having any discussion at that committee of just how this process would work, introducing prevailing wage to private projects. And as far as the electrical trade is concerned, you know, we have a fantastic apprenticeship program here in the state of Oregon. We have fantastic electricians in this state, and it's very difficult for people from outside the state of Oregon to come here and work as an electrician. Fortunately, they have to have an Oregon card to do electrical work, and it's not that easy to get. The guys spend a lot of time and training and classroom work to get that card. So I don't see how making these jobs from prevailing wage is going to have an impact on the electrical industry as far as making those jobs in-state versus somebody coming from out-of-state to take our work. And so I have to say I can't support, I do not support HB 2429 just for the reason I think it is somewhat dangerous as far as if somebody's choosing our state versus another state, we need to be the most competitive that we can. We need to attract jobs here. That's something that we're desperately in need of at this time.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. I've never done this before, relatively new. My name is David Kutz. I'm Vice President of Finance for Paragon Tile, located in Tigard. I prepared a little reading here because as a contractor, a local contractor, feel it's very important to be involved in the front end of this process versus finding out as a result of the secret meetings, as Bob alluded to, of how things actually work. So we are a member of Associated Builders and Contractors, and we're very active in apprenticeship, and we're part of one of the newest and fastest growing apprenticeship programs in Oregon. I'm here today to express my concerns about House Bill 2429. As someone who thinks it would harm Oregon's ability to attract new jobs and grow our economy, the New York State considered a similar proposal last year. A study by the Center for Government Research conducted on behalf of New York Economic Development Council showed that the cost of expanding prevailing wage tax abatement projects would be significant. I believe a copy of this report has been circulated to all of you. Please remember this bill does not deal with the government projects where the lowest bidder must be selected. These are private construction projects where companies like Intel are building significant facilities and are seeing a portion of their property taxes waived for a period of time due to incredible economic benefit that they can provide the area through long-term wages and employment-related taxes. The New York Economic Development Council study looked at the difference in wages between the market wages, median for the craft, and the prevailing wage. They built a hypothetical project and applied the likely craft and wage proportions to the projects. The New York Economic Development Council study found that prevailing wage rates were significantly higher across the crafts and regions. Keep in mind, though, we are talking about crafts where starting wages are, in most cases, $20 an hour or more, even without it being prevailing wage. We've also provided you a one-pager that applies Oregon's market median data and prevailing wage rate data. You will see that the results are not much different. In fairness, wages are not the only cost in these projects. So to see the actual result of the escalator that you are adding to these projects, if you would require prevailing wages, you must also factor the material costs. The New York Economic Development Council study does this and finds that the cost of requiring prevailing wage rates would have meant a 23% increase upstate New York to a 52% increase downstate. In Oregon, I would estimate the increase would be in excess of 20%. However, the methodology has not been applied to determine this. My guess is that the estimate is fairly close, though, and if you look at the information provided. These statistics are before you even consider the cost of construction in terms of the market base wage in other regions considered in the New York study. If Oregon were competing against other similar cities such as Indianapolis, Austin, Tampa, Raleigh, Cleveland, we would be in a world of hurt with this bill. The question for the committee today is, are you willing to gamble that businesses seeking property tax abatements will still come to Oregon to create jobs and stimulate our economy and add to our tax base if you add another 20% or more premium on the cost of building? I think the data speaks for itself and articulates that House Bill 2429 is a bad idea. Please also keep in mind that the state of New York did not adopt these provisions either. Now is not the time for this unless we want our construction economy to remain in its current state for a long time. Please do not take further action on House Bill 2429.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it Mr. Coots? I'm sorry, I didn't...
Coots, correct.
Coots, thank you. You mentioned something about secret meetings?
No, I was just referring to another project that was in the Portland area in the past where a lot of things happened before the public was made aware of it. So.
Thank you.
God knows we can't control what happens up in Portland.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I believe the comment was more in agreement to what Mr. Shipwreck was stating, that, you know, we like these things out in the open and support those involvement in that process versus the
thing
in the background.
Thank you. Well, we're in agreement on something today, right, Sean?
That's good.
Any further questions of these fine gentlemen? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I'm just wondering what you would recommend to put Oregon businesses back to work, because it almost seems to me like maybe those local entities who are benefiting or, I guess, in, well, cahoots with some of these projects that are coming into town and having these code names and all that, it seems like they're not asking the right questions as to, well, who will be building these projects. And so I'm not sure this bill gets us there, but I'm wondering what you would suggest.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, that's a good question, and I think you're right. I think there needs to be more involvement from those the local governments in having those conversations, because although I know there's a question of legality of whether they can require those folks, there is definitely a conversation that can be taken place to try to encourage them to hire local contractors. And so, you know, whether it's by law or it's just done by more involvement, quite frankly, from our organizations, Bob organizations being a part of those discussions, I think there needs to be a better job in that, and local government needs to do a better job of that. But again, I think we do have problems with some legalities of requiring that.
Yes, please, go ahead.
What about these secret meetings? Is that something we can affect?
Well, Representative, I mean, there are public meeting laws on the books, and if they're not being enforced, that's a problem. Do we need more laws to do that? Probably not. Do we need some way to enforce it, or do we need to be more diligent? Maybe. A secret meeting's that I don't like secrets. I never know when to be kept. So, personally, I find them disgusting too, but I share your concern, and I'm glad. I think we're all in agreement on that one. Mm-hmm. That's a no-brainer. To the prevailing wage, though, as Bob has pointed out every session I've been in this committee, it was designed to ensure the hiring of local for help, and it's been successful. Not always, but wildly successful. And my question to Mr. Redmond is, I wonder how many of these license plates belong to card-carrying journeyman electricians. You know, we have a lot of, and you don't need to answer, it's a rhetorical question, there's a lot of non-licensed labor going on and being drug into this state to do for less than what I consider a family wage. And maybe we are losing some revenue because of it. For full disclosure, I don't pay taxes on my per diem either. But when I get paid $20 an hour, 40 hours a week and 50 weeks out of the year, then I'll gladly consider paying taxes on my per diem, just in case anyone wanted to come back with me on that one. Representative Esquivel, then Representative Kanemer.
Yes, we've talked about code names. We talked about secrecy. There is a certain amount of confidentiality when it comes to economic development. And the code names are set up because if you name the entity, it's amazing how the cost of real estate that fits that footprint goes up. So that's the reason for this. It's nothing devious. It's nothing diabolical. It's just the fact that if you come out and let everyone know who's inquiring within your community through your economic development machine, you're going to be detrimental to that individual relocating or building into your area. So I think we need to clear that up.
That being said, though, once the public gets involved and elected officials involved and state and local and county officials are involved, then it's a horse of a different color. When it's on the private side, they can have all the code names, 007 stuff they want. But once the public enters into it, then I think it's a different story. And these enterprise zones provide tax incentives. Therefore, the public is involved. And I think we need to shine some light on it, especially in when you get a city to the north here who literally gives property away to a developer or sells it at discount rates. Representative Kennemer, please.
I guess more to this point and to Sal's point, as a county commissioner who had three urban renewal districts, I guess I take a little exception to secret meetings. I think the law is very clear about confidentiality. And I also take very seriously the point that there's an element of surprise that isn't a very pleasant thing. On the other hand, in my personal experience is without that confidentiality, there have been several of those projects that just flat couldn't have happened because of the impact of competition, whether it's people don't want that enterprise to come and have a competitor locally or whether it's the skyrocketing costs of property or any number of things that affect it. And it's carefully controlled by law, and I hesitate to try to remember because it would be a bad memory about how many hours I sat with lawyers trying to figure out when you do public-private enterprise work where that line is and how to follow the law and not cross that line. And I think we did our due diligence. We followed the law. Maybe there's some question about the law, but that's how we've set it up. And I think most public officials that are involved in that respect that and try to do it by the letter of the law, if not the spirit of the law.
It's a delegate balance.
It is.
I remember being on city council, and every single time anyone who opposed anything, they automatically said, you're in violation of the law, you're violating my constitutional rights, and clearly that wasn't the case. So it is a delicate balance. I definitely recognize that. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to just make a comment that although the talk about secrecy and backroom deals and all of that sort of thing is something of concern, I don't think that this bill directly addresses that. I think this bill is aimed at, you know, making sure that contractors compete on the amount of value and that they can bring to a project and the ability of them to perform the work, while at the same time they don't undermine the area wages of our communities. And you know, I guess you know, looking at New York's example, I don't know how pertinent it is. It's pretty hard for me to believe, but I don't think it's pertinent to Oregon, where you have prevailing wages that are, you know, based on median averages. You know, when you would consider, I think the last time I heard that the amount of labor in a given building project's roughly around 20 to 22% of the total project costs. You know, to think that the difference between the prevailed rate and whatever the a low bid rate might be that had no bottom, it's pretty hard to believe that it would be 20%. That would drive the cost up. I think Mr. Shiprack made a pretty good argument that, you know, based on data, that the cost to the project really, the wages aren't that driving force. You know, they're not that that market thing. And from my standpoint, it seems like we'd want to make sure that our community members are getting a decent wage that's based on what's prevalent in our market, and not based on somebody being able to come in and underbid it, the project, using wages that aren't living wages for the community. So I just wanted to make that on the record. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative, for dragging us back into the discussion of the bill. It's always helpful, and I can count on you to do that. And you know, we talk about the data. The data has been presented to me for years now that prevailing jobs come in on time, under budget, saving us money. So you guys knew coming up here where I was at on this. You know whose name's on the top of the bill. Any more questions of these fine gentlemen? Thank you very much.
Question for you, maybe just for whoever out there might know. I'm not real clear on how these E-zone incentives are applied. Is it, it's just on the property taxes, on the improved property after a project's been built? What, how is it applied?
Well, the eligibility is spelled out in ORS 285C200, I believe, and I'm going to leave that for a lawyer to describe if we have anybody out there who wants to come up and describe that for us. Anybody in the room? And we will get that answer for you, that specific technical, fine, legal question to answer, represent. Please, come on up and identify yourself. And
it's also equipment. It's also
medical. You guys on the list?
I know
Mr.
People in certain ways.
We're going to get that answer for you right now, Representative.
Chairman and committee members, thank you very much for allowing us to testify this morning on 2429 House Bill. My name is Raymond Burstead. I'm the president of the Strategic Economic Development Corporation serving Marion and Polk counties. I'm also the zone manager for the Salem Enterprise Zone. A bit of history to answer Representative Thatcher's question. The Enterprise Zone, what qualifies for exemption in the Enterprise Zone is any new construction or equipment that is brought into an enterprise zone. If you add on to an existing building, the amount you add on qualifies. If you bring in new equipment, that new equipment qualifies. That's all it qualifies. The land does not qualify, and any existing building does not qualify. So it's new construction, new buildings.
So just to clarify, it's the actual cost of the
cost.
New construction.
Okay. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And then the county, or they traditionally base it on a, you know, when the assessor gets out and assesses the property, it's generally at about 80% of what that cost was, is what the assessed value comes in at. So that's where the tax base is based on, 80% of the actual cost. Now, what I would like to address this morning regarding my position and the position of my organization on this bill is, and I can give it to you in a couple of different ways. Initially,
excuse me. Let me, I just want to interrupt. And there's one more thing: is you can also negotiate the amount of time that those credits or tax breaks go. So it can be from 1 year to
3 years. Is pretty much an automatic. If you go above 3 years, it's based on 150% of the average wage for those jobs in the community. So
yeah,
if you get the 5 year exemption, you're going to pay 150% of the average wage in the county at the
Mr.
time.
Chair.
So,
and there are limits on equipment too.
Yes.
It can't be past the life of the equipment,
right,
and so forth.
Depreciation and all that.
Representative, is this relating to
exactly for the enterprise zones?
Okay, go ahead.
Back in my mind, and it's been a while since I've been involved in this. It's been about 6-7 years, and I can't remember if it was e-commerce overlays and or enterprise zones, but isn't there also a stipulation you have to hire so many people at a certain wage in the prevailing area?
If you qualify for the extended abatement, the extra 2 years, you have to, it's what's called the Oregon First Source Hiring Agreement. It means that all of the jobs that are offered in that, for that new company or whatever is being built there, have to be first offered to Oregonians through the Oregon Department of Employment.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Tom Hughes, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Economic Development Association, but I have some familiarity with the enterprise zone that was created in Hillsboro, as I happen to have been the mayor at the time it was created. And so the other addition that I would add to Representative Kennemer's description is that if the applicant chooses to take a fourth or fifth year abatement, the individual zone managers are allowed to design some specific requirements. So, for example, in Hillsboro, we have a local purchase requirement. We have a wage requirement, and I know that in the Clatsop County zone, they also have, actually as a result of the WANA experience that Mr. Shiprock referenced earlier, they actually have a prevailing wage provision in their enterprise zone. So that does exist at the local level for the fourth and fifth year. If you apply for the fourth and fifth year, you may have to meet specific qualifications established by the local governments.
They don't have to use those, but they're in the statute that created the enterprise zones. They can use them.
And just before we move on, if there's any technical questions about the statute, the chair is not going to answer them. Legal counsel is going to answer them. Legislative counsel is going to answer them. Not me. So just thanks for everything in this committee for the rest of the session. So there
Mr.
we go.
Chair, I would say a word on that, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can tell you how it, I can.
Let's briefly do that. Let's briefly do that, and then I want to hear your testimony relative to this bill.
Well, I would go ahead and defer to Ray on how the Salem one operates, and then I would prefer to just go into my testimony then.
I'll give you an example, Chairman, and the rest of the committee. We spent 11 months recruiting Sanyo, our organization did, along with our other resource partners. We were in competition with five other states for that project, and had it not been for the enterprise zone, and other states had enterprise zones, so that wasn't the total thing that brought them here, but had it not been for the enterprise zones, I am confident we would not have had a chance at that opportunity. And they're going to build an $84 million plant and put 200 Oregonians to work at an average salary of salary and benefits in excess of $50,000. So we felt that was an important project for our community and for our workers here in Marion County. If you take the bill as it's written, and $5 million is the number that's been thrown out there, and I've checked with the contracting engineer for the Sanyo project and just asked him point blank, how are the bids going, who's getting the bids, what are you finding for the cost of construction here in Marion County? And he has told me across the board, his name's Steve Green with Inspect, that across the board, the union bids and the non-union bids, there's about a 24 to 26% differential. If you add just 20% to a construction job, a $5 million construction job, it's going to cost the contractor an extra million. So that $5 million project becomes six. The enterprise zone advantage or incentive that is given to that company over a three-year period is only $297,000 total. Why would he go to an enterprise zone? I mean, the whole idea is to draw companies into these enterprise zones to get this property that's not being fully utilized to bring jobs and capital investment into those. If you take away that incentive, if the incentive of the enterprise zone goes away, it's going to be very difficult for us to recruit people into those zones.
And can you get that example for us in writing somewhere?
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, I would, I guess, add to Ray's testimony a little bit in terms of the functioning. We have an enterprise zone in Hillsboro that has existed for 2 years. And I think one of the things that's important to understand for the committee to understand about the enterprise zone as a particular tool is that it ties the tax abatement to job creation in areas where there is demonstrable levels of poverty. And so a lot of people don't think of Washington County or Hillsboro as poverty-ridden, but in point of fact, we have a portion of town that has stubborn, persistent, pretty ugly levels of poverty that we've been trying to work on for a long, long time. What we've done with the enterprise program in Hillsboro is that if the applicant agrees to the 4 and 5 years extension of the basic 3 year, the fourth and fifth year we claw back 25% of the abatement, put it into a program which we then use for a training program for the residents of the zone that are in the area that where the poverty exists. So in our particular case, for example, we discovered that in two of the census tracts in our zone, the GED attainment for 18-year-old and above adults was about 45%. That is comparable to an average in the state of Oregon of about 86% and in Washington County of about 91%. So clearly the folks in that zone can't work their way out of poverty until they have a basic GED. And so the money that we're going to put into the program will focus on creating a GED program, building basic job skills, and then going back to the companies that are receiving the abatement and saying, what can we do to train these people so they can become employees of yours? yours. So we think that that connection between jobs and poverty is a really important element, which the current law is flexible enough to allow you to do. I would make just a couple of quick comments that about the current law that I have, about which I have some concerns. For example, the $5 million, and I'm glad that Bob suggested they just pull that out of the air, because it did have that sort of "I just pulled it out of the air" feel to it. The problem is that the language in the statute that allows for the availability of the enterprise zone, it says projected project costs of $50,000. So they've included that language, projected project cost of over $5 million in the language on the trigger for what triggers prevailing wage. In reality, a job that projected at $5 million for the project might not have $5 million worth of tax abatement in it, number one. And number two, it probably is not going to have $5 million worth of construction costs that would carry prevailing wages. And so what I would recommend that you might think about as a possible change to this particular bill is $5 million for the projected construction cost, because that's the part of it that you really want to deal with, is the part that deals with construction. I would suggest a couple things to you, though. One of them is that, as Mr. Shipwreck went through his list of offenders, the offenses are kind of mind-boggling. We have eight successful applicants who have been under construction in Hillsborough in the last 2 years. Four of them would have been qualified under this particular bill. And of those four, Genentech, Solar World, TriQuint, and TOK, all four have, to the best of my knowledge, paid market rate on their construction costs. And I know, at least particularly in the Genentech distribution center, the steel fabricator came out for the topping off ceremony and talked about how much money had been spent by Genentech hiring the top level steel workers to work that project. Part of that is because private sector jobs, construction jobs in particular, get evaluated differently than public sector jobs. In a private sector job, for example, the quality of construction carries value for the life of the project that it helps the owner then in realizing his return on investment. He may have specific purposes for the construction, to build an environment that allows for people to work better together. Those kinds of things wind up, unfortunately or unfortunately, being more important in the private sector and something they're willing to spend money on, whereas in the public sector we're not allowed to do that simply because we're trying to cut costs, because we go with the low bidder. So I think that you'd always find a minimum number of the private sector jobs that would be in violation of any kind of standard that we would set for fair wages. For the most part, and again, our experience in Hillsborough has been that on the $80 million project at Genentech and the $365 million, I think, that Solar World has currently spent, and I believe it was $45 million on TriQuint, that those projects all contributed a considerable amount of money back into the economy by hiring local workers at fair market rates, and now we'll also have people who are working at 150% of the average wage. The current law offers the kind of flexibility that you need at a specific level, as they did in Clatsop County, to address the issue of prevailing wage. And I assure you that if we had ever been burned in Hillsborough with a construction job, we would make sure that never happened again. There is not a local elected official in the state of Oregon that wants to have his local resident workers either set aside and not hired at all, or taken advantage of by being paid low wages. And so the assumption is that both in the construction phase and the regular phase, we're going to create good family wage jobs by spending this money. And again, in our case, tie it back to training more workers so that we have the workforce that we need.
One last point, and I'll be done as well. I checked with the contractor on this annual project again, and he told me that the electrical contract, the plumbing contract, the HVAC contract, and the steel contract all went to Salem Oregon companies, and the concrete contract went to a Portland company. So they are spending their money in the Mid-Willamette Valley. And that's, though we can't, as economic developers and as zone managers, and they're negotiating these deals with these companies, we can't go to them and say, you will hire Oregon contractors and you will do put Oregon people to work. We can tell them that when they get ready to hire their employees, because that's one of the stipulations in the enterprise zone. But for the contracting side, we can't do that. We strongly recommend it.
Well, Mr. Hughes and Mr. Birdstead, I said that right. You know, I appreciate your testimony. And as so often is the case, people that are out there doing the right thing get drug right in, but those that are doing the wrong thing. I believe everything you just said, but on the other hand, if there's those out there that aren't as civic-minded as you fellows, then what am I supposed to do? You know, it's so what I recommend, you don't even have to answer that, is Mr. Shiptrack's right over there. It's a deliberative process. See if you can work something out, and good luck to you. Any questions of these fine gentlemen?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Cameron.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Burstead, you mentioned, and I want to go back because you just talked about local contractors, and we've heard testimony today. There's nothing in this bill that would make local contractors any more prevalent.
Right.
What specifically in this contract with Sanyo would be different if this bill was law today? What would be taking place in the dollar amounts in their construction?
Well, their total construction on the building and site is about $11 million. So best estimate, you'd add another $2.5 million to that. And that would have been a major concern to them for the project.
And that's follow up, if I may.
Please.
And relative to the savings in the enterprise zone, maybe you said that already. And what are they looking at?
Well, they have a tremendous amount of equipment coming in. Their total property tax savings over a 5-year period, because they're hiring worker at 1.5% times the average wage of the workforce in Marion County. Their total tax relief is going to be in the neighborhood of, over a 5-year period, in the neighborhood of $6.5 million.
Thank you.
And that's what I'd like a written breakdown on, that example. And I would like the justification and explanation of why that higher number would be if this were the statute right now today.
Okay.
Please, thank you. Representative Thatcher, then Representative Holvey.
I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it's kind of alarming to me that the prevailing wage, if Sanyo were to have paid that, if this bill were in place, it would have cost them $2 million more. If that were true, that tells me that they're paying their construction workers $2 million less than what the community average is. So that's sort of disturbing by itself. I'm trying to figure out how you're getting there. And then one other thing, Mr. Hughes had also talked about the threshold for what would make this a prevailing wage in discussion of the $5 million. I guess from the way I'm looking at it, a tax abatement, if the enterprise zone didn't exist, you know, that company would be paying that money in that's been abated to our local governments, essentially. And so it sort of makes it look like it's in lieu of public funds. So, and I think right now the threshold for prevailing wage is $50,000. If you have $50,000 of public funds, it becomes a public project.
$750,000 was what was said in the last session.
$750,000 is for a public-private partnership,
right?
Specifically. I think if you look, you'll see that $50,000 of public funds is the threshold for, if you use $50,000 public funds, it's a prevailing wage project. Now, the public-private partnership is a special case that uses $750,000. I agree with that. So if you get a if you're looking at a threshold, I would say if you're getting a tax abatement worth more than $50,000, it ought to be a prevailing wage job, because that's $50,000 of public funds you don't have now.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hovey, I don't know how you could view a tax abatement for a private project as anything but a public-private partnership. If you were going to include it under the prevailing wage law at all, it would seem to me that it would have to qualify as a public-private partnership, since it's not a public work. It's not a publicly owned project, and the $50,000, I believe, applies to public projects that are competitively bid and are owned and operated by the public. So, but your question points up another concern about the bill, and that is that what you basically do is you take prevailing wage law, which is a separate section of the law, and then mesh it with the enterprise zone law, which is a different portion of the law. And there's a question, I think, in the minds of the professionals who will ultimately have to administer this, of how you go about enforcing that. So they're projecting, let's say the $5 million projected value stays there. They're projecting a value of $5 million. What if they project under $5 million and are wrong? There is nobody in the loop now. Normally what happens is an agreement is reached between the zone operator and the county that tags that property for a tax abatement. The county assessor's office doesn't get much information in terms of what wages were paid to the workers on the, not specifically the kinds of information that prevailing wage requires, nor would the zone operator necessarily get that. And so there's some confusion, I think, in my mind about how those two laws mesh together. And part of the problem in meshing is this whole question about what triggers prevailing wage, because in point of fact, you may project a project as having $5 million worth of value, but the value of the building itself, the tax abatement on the value of the building itself, may be less than the $750,000 that would trigger a public-private partnership. So in that case, you'd almost be better off as a government to simply say, gee, we'll give you $749,000, and they'd make out better than they would under the enterprise zone, which was will now be called out for specific attention in a way that I'm not sure I completely understand how it's ever going to get enforced. So,
well, they better sharpen their pencil, too, because you better be right. I really don't have any sympathy for anybody that comes in and says, oh, we were wrong after the project's completed. I have an issue with that. We increased the trigger, I think, out of sympathy to local government from $25,000 to $50,000. And my friend right down here and I, we would have made it $2,000 cash, land, tax credit, tax abatement, enterprise, anything. So and there are states out there that do it. And they're not starving to death, but that's another issue in another bill. Representative, are you finished over there? And that was what I was trying to get at when I asked the good gentleman to bring that back and write and show me where that difference comes from.
I just wanted to answer Representative Hovey's question, because I have a quote here from Steve Green, who's a senior project manager for Inspect, who are the contractors on the Sanyo project, and he said, we have noticed a clear differential of 26% between non-union and union bids for projects at our Salem site.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let's get going.
I'm repeatedly hearing about 24 to 26% wage differentials. Do contractors look exclusively at wage rates? Do they not consider unit labor costs? I mean, as a class of
project cost, not labor cost. I mean, if it was a bid for electrical, let's say, one bid came in at $500,000, one bid came in at $630,000, there was a 26% differential.
So as
might
a
not have all been labor.
And Mr. Chairman,
please,
if I might. So you're going to tell me that contractors don't look at productivity as a class? No offense to any individuals, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, please.
But as a class, you're going to tell us that contractors are unsophisticated enough to be looking at productivity?
Absolutely not.
Thank you.
I would not say that.
Thank you for making that point, Representative. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Apparently, you're aware of what other states are doing, who you're competing with here. I'm wondering if there are any other states with E-zones who do require prevailing wage at any level.
Not that I know of.
I think the OECD and some others are in the process of researching that, and I believe that they think that there are three or four other examples out there of states that do, but I'm not sure which they are, so I don't know if they're states with whom we've had recent competition. We normally are in competition with Texas.
And I'm going to ask my trusted administrator to look that up for us, please. Mm-hmm. Representative Holby.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, just one real quick thing. I know that, you know, the testimony is that there's a differential of 20 to 26% between union and non-union scale in this particular instance, but this bill is about prevailing wage. It isn't about union or non-union scale. This is about the average for the area. So, to me, that's a meaningless statement in regards to this bill. Thank you.
Representative. Gentlemen, do you have anything further to add?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you very much.
Oh, let's see here.
I'd like to call Doris Panwell and Michael Novak and Ron Paxtor, please. Whenever you first want to sit down, just go ahead and go for it, guys.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome.
I have a blissfully short prepared statement. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Novak with the League of Oregon Cities. I thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today concerning House Bill 2429. The League of Oregon Cities represents 242 cities across the state, all totaled large and small. These cities contain roughly 80% of Oregon's population. Paramount to these cities is to retain local control in the decision-making process, to have the opportunity to judge for themselves the correct actions to bring the greatest benefits to their community. House Bill 2429 jeopardizes the decision-making authority of Oregon cities. Enterprise zones have been an essential facet in helping stimulate our economy. Private participation in enterprise zones has led to successful growth in Oregon communities over the decades. This participation is fostered by those on the ground in the local communities, having options to bring the correct tools to bear to find solutions and entice businesses to Oregon and into their own backyards. It is the local enterprise zone boards who are responsible for development and implementation of the programs. Yet House Bill 2429 takes away authority from those who best know local conditions and needs, restricting local communities and cities, large or small, in their ability to effectively meet the challenges of the current economy. Enterprise zones as they operate today in Oregon are working. Extending prevailing wage mandates to private construction in enterprise zones adds an obstacle to construction, which defeats the purpose and many see as a barrier to creating new jobs. Prevailing wage language makes businesses looking to Oregon wary as they foresee rising construction costs, ultimately hindering economic development and job creation efforts. There are arguments that the prevailing wage does not increase the overall cost to a project or that the cost is minimal. I would proffer up to this committee that in a general sense, whether it does or not, may not really matter because businesses believe that it does, and they factor that belief into their bottom line decisions. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you.
Go ahead. You want me to? Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Doris Penwell. I represent the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm here today to speak in opposition to the way of trying to implement prevailing wage in construction contracts in enterprise zones. This proposal, and I have written testimony here that will go into some much detail about many things you've already heard, but I'd like to just hit on several points. First of all, there are 59 enterprise zones, and cities, counties, ports, and one tribe are co-sponsors of those enterprise zones here in Oregon. They are established when local entities decide that they want to establish an enterprise zone. And if they don't want to because they believe that the tax abatement is not something they can afford, then they don't establish them. Or if they can't agree on the provisions, they don't establish them. So this is a local option by local officials to decide to give tax abatement to businesses to expand into an enterprise zone. There are many businesses that sit in an enterprise zone. Some use the tax abatement provision, some don't. We get business investment from out of state, we get it from out of country, and we get it an expansion most frequently of businesses that are already in the zone and are doing new construction. And as you have heard from other testimony, they are being the tax abatement is in this bill the fourth and fifth year of an enterprise zone provision. The first 3 years is automatic, and there's not much, if you meet the terms of the statute, there's not much different with one business to another in terms of how they operate. They just have to meet the terms of the statute. But in this bill, it regards the fourth and fifth year of an abatement, and you have to pay 150% of average wage and have more employees. In this bill, this discusses just the construction phase of the project. This is not even during the period that they are receiving their abatement. It's during the construction in process, which is outside of the enterprise zone provision when it goes into effect. When a business applies for a project of investment, they estimate the project, and the assessor receives this application. It's after the construction is completed and they are ready to enter into the operational phase of the business and receive any abatement that they actually have the final cost of the project, construction cost of the project that is under abatement. So therefore, there is a difference between what's happening during construction phase and the estimates and what's happening during the final abatement. So there's in our minds, there is some difficulty with the way that the bill is written to start with, but that's all right. Those things can be taken care of. At the end of my testimony, I talked about several questions that we still wonder about how the bill is written, how it would work, moving it from a public process to a private process, whether businesses sitting in the zone actually, if they estimate wrong, would they lose both their construction and process exemption as well as their enterprise zone exemption? It's unclear in the bill. One reason the counties particularly like the local decision-making and the current process for enterprise zone operations is that they have every county, every city has a different circumstance in terms of their economy, the wages paid, the needs they have for competition, and in many of the places around Oregon, they have great difficulty in getting these big projects. It is, I suspect, but actual experience because prevailing wage has not been required at the local level. Not been required, however, it is used at the local level. There may be some competitive problems with getting these big projects in rural areas. I suspect that in urban areas there isn't nearly the issue that we would have in rural areas. So I think the impact of this bill would probably be felt there more than in the urban areas. In the last 4 years, the local economy and the state economy has really reduced the tools that local officials and state officials have to do any kind of business recruitment, expansion of business. We almost have no funding available at the state level or the local level to do anything to entice businesses to do more expansion, more investment. This is one of the few tools we have left that is very important, and it's a great marketing tool for Oregon, and we believe that we'd like to be able to make these decisions at the local level. Now, in closing, I'd like to say that I believe that some of the education that Bob Shiprack and the people that he is involved with has been very helpful around the state with local officials and making them understand how wage rates and local hiring make a difference. And construction wages are just as important to the local officials as they are to the building trades. I think that we could always do a lot more education at the local level. And when they do receive this education, it does make a difference. So if there's anything that needs to be beefed up, it could be in the way the zone process works and how we do training and administration, both at the state and local level. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Papsdorf, representative of the city of Gresham today. I wanted to bring the conversation back a little bit to kind of the prevailing wage issue. And to me, the debate about this bill isn't about prevailing wage and the value of prevailing wage, or should we or shouldn't we have prevailing wage. Prevailing wage is targeted to public works for a very simple reason. At our public agency level, we're required to award bids to the lowest qualified bidder. The last thing we want to do with those public contracts is allow low labor costs to undercut the labor market for those projects where the thing that we look at is just the bid price. On the private construction side, those companies that are recruiting construction activities for their private business have the ability to make their contractor selections on any number of issues that's important to them. They may have very specialized equipment, and they may have a long-standing relationship with a company that knows how to deal with their specialized equipment and the special installation requirements of that equipment. On a quick review of the 33 states in the country that have a prevailing wage law, I found two states that extend prevailing wage to private activities that receive a tax benefit or a tax incentive program. I think clearly the vast majority of states have determined that there is a clear difference between a public work and a private project that happens to get a short-term tax incentive as a recruitment tool for that private investment in the community. And then before I wrap up, and I don't want to repeat a lot of the other testimony that's occurred this morning, I do want to talk a little bit about Gresham's Enterprise Zone that's been in place for about 3 years now. We have attracted three investments in our Enterprise Zone. Those investments have totaled over $56 million of private investment in equipment and new facilities and have created 240 plus new jobs in the community, permanent jobs in the community. That's very important to us. One of those companies was Boeing, which had an existing plant in Gresham. When the Boeing Corporation was looking at expansion into an expanded business within their corporation, individual business units within Boeing Corporation had to compete with each other, including the Gresham Boeing plant. This enterprise zone was one of those determining factors for Boeing to decide to make that investment at the Gresham plant as opposed to one of their other facilities around the country. We strongly believe that for these companies that take advantage of the enterprise zone, in the vast majority of cases, these investments would not happen in these locations but for the enterprise zone. So I think when our mayor and city council determine whether to extend or create an enterprise zone and provide that benefit to private investment, they really don't feel like they are foregoing property tax revenue for a short period of time, because that abatement is for property tax revenue they wouldn't have received but for that private investment by that private company. And then the long-term property tax revenue created by that investment far outweighs any short-term property tax abatement we provide.
Thank you for your testimony. And just so everybody's clear, you know, in no way, shape, or form do I or any proponents of this bill want to say enterprise zones are a bad thing. We want investment in this state. We want to help investment in this state. If it's a private investment over here, they can do whatever they want and hire whoever they want, and they'll get what they pay for. But when the government's involved, when we give something, I think it's only right, and we should be obligated to ask for something in return. I don't know, if you just look back over the last 10 years, we've been given and given and given, and what have we been getting back in a wide range of areas?
And I want to make sure, the intent of this is to make damn sure that Oregon workers build these projects and get paid a living wage. And I know there are, I want to repeat this again, I believe most people are good and honest and care about their community. But when there's some bad players out there, we all get drug in the same. And then you've got to just figure out a way to avoid that. That's what this is about. Now, I'm open to ideas to make things more clear or more fair or more acceptable. But the intent of this is to make sure that Oregon workers are building these projects and that they're getting paid family wages and aren't on some role. Their children don't have to go and sign up for the Oregon Health Plan, because when you pay substandard wages, then that's what that leads to. And I just want to make sure everyone knows where I'm coming from here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I'm just speaking to the record now, just because for legislative history purposes. I cannot speak, of course, for the chairman, but I believe the intent of this bill is to ensure that wages on projects in enterprise zones of more than $5 million prevail. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions of these fine Americans? Representative Thatcher.
Earlier testimony, I believe it was from Bob Shiprock, stated that he had discussions with some local officials who said, you know, I didn't even give any consideration to who was going to be building this project. Do you agree that you talked a little bit about education? Mm-hmm. Is that part of what you are talking about when you're talking about education, talking to local officials and making sure they're asking the right questions to encourage the right answers?
Mr. Chair and Representative Thatcher, that may be part of what I'm talking about. You know, every county, every city has their own public officials. The ones that are involved in these enterprise zone decisions understand very clearly, you know, where you might be able to impose certain conditions. I, like I said before, I think Mr. Shiprock and some of his peers have done a very good job of educating in areas where there's been a problem, and I think people are surprised about the how far they may be able to go in terms of negotiating with businesses that are putting in large projects. The law actually allows for additional provisions to be imposed, and as like I said before, I think it's just an education process. It's a kind of a complicated statute, and if you want to look at it. So, you know, you're a new public official. You may or may not know how far you can go in terms of leveraging, the benefits. But that's sort of what I'm talking about. I think most public officials that have any experience at all are very careful about these kind of things, because they're not interested in giving up increased taxes any more than anyone else is. They need them badly at the local level.
More?
Not a follow-up, but I heard somebody say, I believe it was you from the City of Gresham, saying that you're aware of two other states that implement prevailing wage requirements in their E-zones. Could you elaborate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, a report that I reviewed from 2007, I think was done for the California State Legislature, identified two states that apply their prevailing wage laws to private projects that receive a tax incentive. I don't know whether those two states have the equivalent of our enterprise zone program, but it was a broad application of the prevailing wage. So that's two states out of 33 states that have prevailing wage laws. I believe they were Minnesota and New Jersey.
And just for the record, the intent of this bill is that these jobs prevail. It's unconstitutional to force the hiring of Oregonians. There we are. And Representative Cameron, then we're going to move on to two more witnesses, and then we're going to...
Well, I just wanted to make a comment. I didn't have a question for our witnesses today, but a comment about long-term jobs. And we heard prior testimony about the jobs here locally that will be here long-term, 150% of the average. Marion County has one of the lowest levels of poverty in this state, and my concern is representing the people that I represent. Is that we have long-term jobs that come to this state, and I think we need to really be careful as we consider things that in the short term may reduce long-term jobs coming here. And I just want to approach that with caution. And I hear the flexibility at the local level is a real priority in this bill, and we want to maintain that we have that flexibility for local officials to do the good jobs that they have in bringing jobs to Oregon that will help increase family wage jobs in the long run. Thank you.
Any further questions of these nice folks? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And two folks left. And if there's anybody else who wants to speak, sir, let me know. Daniel Bonham and Jenna Kaluza. Hope I said those names right. Come on up. And I apologize for you all being at the end of the line. Nothing personal. Jenna, go ahead.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jenna Kaluza, and I'm the state director with the National Federation of Independent Business here in Oregon. And I'm here today to testify in opposition to House Bill 2429. I'm going to keep my testimony short in interest of time. I'd like to echo the concerns of my colleagues who've gone before me. We view enterprise zones as an opportunity to invest in those areas and to grow business. I think my members' concerns would be that when they make a decision to invest in that area or to grow their business, it's a tough decision, especially in this economy, and our worry is that an increased cost of business would make it so that they wouldn't choose to then invest. So I'm happy to take any questions that you have. I think that's kind of that's our biggest concern, as well as the concerns that have been addressed. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Chairman Schaffler, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Daniel Bonham. I'm the executive director of the Fair Oregon Southwest and Oregon Southwest Washington Fair Contracting Foundation. I'm not here to speak either in favor of or against the bill. I'm neutral on that area, but there's a couple of things that I wanted to point out as a correction as I heard the testimony today. This bill is about prevailing wage. Whether or not to apply it, and there is the opposition that we've heard today in the testimony has been basically in opposition to the idea of prevailing wages. Some testimony has been given that the prevailing wage increases costs X amount of dollars. There's a lot of debate on both sides of that. There's a lot of data on both sides of that issue. There's a lot of studies that have been done, and I'm very familiar with most of them because that's my job. What I've noticed with various studies is that they're quite often apples and oranges comparisons, where you will take certain kinds of broad employment data, apply it, and then other studies will apply very narrow data. The studies, in my experience, and I can show this, which do actually get to accurate information as far as the cost increases of prevailing wages, are those which are done after the fact, not projections of what might occur in the future, or even if you take bid data. Sometimes contractors will come in and they will see completely different kinds of aspects as they're preparing their bid documentation to go to bid on a project, and therefore you're going to get some very wild differences in those. So those are not accurate forms of data. I'm aware of one study which has been done here in the state of Oregon, which was under the previous Commissioner of Labor, Dan Gardner, on a project euphemistically called the Tin Roof up in the Portland area, in which they took the data of a project that did not go prevailing wage, that there was a dispute over whether or not the prevailing wage should be applied to that project, and then afterwards, without the prevailing wages, the commissioner directed that a study be done on how much more it would have cost to perform that project. It was a $2.5 million project, I believe, which would not have even come under this bill. But the overall costs, and generally speaking, in construction, the smaller the project, the larger the labor percentage cost. The overall cost increase for that project was 8% if the prevailing wage had been applied. If you take into the hidden costs of the community, some of the things that Representative Witt was talking about as far as the actual the labor differentials, then it's quite possible that in situations like that, the application of the prevailing wage will make a project cost less in its long run. Now, there was a very good point made in earlier testimony that it's not so much whether or not the prevailing wage does or does not cost more to a project, it is the perception of the business community. That is a failing on the part of many of us that we haven't been able to educate the business community in many areas, that the prevailing wage does not significantly increase the overall cost of the project. An 8% increase is an 8% increase, but is it a significant overall cost to the project, especially when you compare the other benefits? The other correction that I'd like to suggest to the committee is that when you have out-of-state companies coming in which bring licensed trades such as plumbing, steam fitting, boiler makers, electrical, that they need to get the necessary licensing for the state. The enforcement of those laws is very lax in this state. Now, I don't have any data on that. It's anecdotal. One of the things that we do with the foundation is we actually go out to the projects and talk to the workers. And from our anecdotal information, we're finding that when you do bring in contractors from a place like Texas or the South or places like that, that they fail to get the local Oregon licenses, and that's something that needs to be looked at here. Now, this does not have a requirement for contractors to come in or to be local contractors. The entire idea behind the Davis-Bacon laws in the first place, and our little Davis-Bacon, is to protect the local wage, the area standards. And if a contractor has to pay those standards, they're very unlikely to bring in out of state. That's the whole idea behind the prevailing wage. And so although there's no direct requirement that they have local hire, which would be unconstitutional, the effect of the prevailing wage is to get local.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Well, this is a public hearing. Anyone else today, well, we're going to hear it again, would like to testify to House Bill 2429. Seeing none, close the hearing on House Bill 2429. Anything for the good of the order today? All right, we're adjourned.